this one out loud.
Woohoo! Good morning, good morning, good morning. No, good afternoon. Well, whatever. Good Ooh! Day. Good day to you.
I love the energy, Annie B.
I know. Woo, woo. I know. I got up. I worked out.
I'm rubbing off on you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Roll switch.
Roll switch. Well, I am feeling really, I have a little bit of anxiety today, actually. Uh-oh. So, like,
I'm so
glad
sorry.
You kicked off the convo with your good energy. No, it's okay. It's not really, like, down anxiety. It's just, like, hyperactive, incessantly thinking about what could go wrong with some things, because my friend and I were together and she got married last year in August, you know, my bestie. Yep. I won't name yep. her because of what we're talking about, but she and I were talking about getting pregnant because, you know, that's what she wants to do. She got married, she wants a bebe, and she is super freaked out for some reason that she's not going to be able to get pregnant with no reason.
Well, no, I think women, like, are getting married later, you know, right? You're getting married later. So it used to be,
true.
You know, You're 22, and now you're 30, 32, 42. You know, the world has changed on that level.
It's true. It's true. But I guess I'm like, I didn't think I was going to, because, you know, I'm really good at comforting other people. So I was telling her, like, you just got, you know, your birth control method, like, removed. Like, don't worry. Like, you're so in the beginning. You're fine. You're young. You're healthy. Like, you've never had an issue. Like, don't worry about it. Like, just try and don't stress yourself out. And then I started thinking about it, even though I'm not even married yet, and I'm not trying to have children, let me be clear. But
I know when I first met you, you're like, I don't even know if I want children.
True. No, I mean, that's changed. I do. Not right now. But I was just thinking about it and I was like, oh my God, I have, unlike my friend, I have been on birth control consistently, literally every day, every month, every year since I was 14. And I'm 29.
I know. How many times has your birth control alarm gone off when we're in the middle of a meeting?
Exactly. Everyone in the world knows, oh, Ariel needs to take her birth control. They know the ringer that I have. So it's just this thing. And the whole point that I came to is that, why am I freaking out over something that I don't even understand? And why don't I understand fertility, about, like, my own body and its ability to do something? So anyway, I'm very excited about our conversation today. I'm hoping it'll steady me a little bit and maybe give me something that I can share with my friend.
For sure. And that's exactly what we do here on Bring a Friend. So this guest is actually a longtime friend. She was my original OG Parlay House, you know, sidekick when we first began this whole thing. So I'm glad that her world has spinned into one of knowledge and support for women along their journey. And anyway, I don't want to give too much away. So Leslie, tell us all about yourself.
I'm Leslie Schrock. I am an author of two books. I'm an angel investor, mostly in family, women's health, reproductive health, and I am the mom of two boys under four, and that is a real adventure.
You look damn good for that.
I know.
I must say. Yeah. You know, I've never had sons or brothers, but I see these moms of these highly energetic young boys, and I'm like, wow, how is your hair blown out? You know,
this is called there's a Dyson attachment. There's a Dyson attachment that
it
I use for approximately 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the
before
best.
My two boys start killing each other. TJ likes to get in Dylan's crib now in the morning and I can see them on the monitor.
Oh my God.
And
terrifying.
Then I just use the Dyson thing like for 30 seconds.
Knowing
and it
that
works,
they're
like,
entertaining
done.
Each other for that long and no one.
Yeah.
No
or
one
they're stepping on each other or, you know, murdering each other. That's what it sounds like sometimes.
But you just dropped so many unusual, you know, self-identifying bombs beyond motherhood into this. And, you know, one of the things that you've said to me before is that you're sort of an accidental writer. And I think that's probably a really mm-hmm. good place to start this conversation, because I'm a purposeful writer, not always so good, but doing my best. And yet you're a fabulous author, but you didn't start off to be that in your life. Can you talk to us a little bit about your journey and why it was all an accident?
Well, like you, I had an ex-life in advertising, and I was not a writer. I was a designer. I was an art director, creative director, did that for a while before I jumped into startup land. And really the reason that I chose design when I was in school as kind of a specialization is because it was the thing I couldn't do. I could write. I was a fine writer even then, although I'd never written anything particularly long or meaningful. And I just wanted to become skilled at something. And so I learned design. But I think, as everyone on this call knows, I am a very B designer. I am. There are other people like your sister
who are much better. My sister's a great designer.
It was actually one of the greatest moments of my professional life. My last boss in advertising let me off the hook. He, in my performance review, like year one, he was like, "Wow, like here are all the ways that you're great. But like, honestly, Leslie, you're a B designer. And like, you're always going to be a B designer." And yeah. I, you know, initially had that, and then it was like relief. Like finally someone had called it. Someone had told me the thing I needed to hear, and it made me free. And I think that I really carried that lesson with me. And I still carry it with me. I still adore this old boss of mine for that reason, because sometimes you just need someone to tell you what you're not good at to free you up to do the things that you are. So the accidental author thing happened because I have been working in women's and reproductive health for a long time. I've been working with health startups for over 10 years now. And then I decided to get pregnant. And I was 35 and thought, well, everyone's doing it. And I know all this stuff. And I have access to all these medical professionals through my work and going to be totally fine and easy. And as you know well, not so easy.
No.
I had to fail. Yeah, it was brutal.
Tell us your story, because I think listeners think that they're the only ones who are having a hard time, when in fact having a hard time is more the norm these days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one in six couples has trouble conceiving, so it's very, very normal. In fact, I think that number is a bit conservative. So what happened to me is we tried and I got pregnant right away. And then 2 weeks later, I had a miscarriage in a remote part of Canada, oddly enough. I was on a ski trip and, you know, went to the hospital. They confirmed that it was a miscarriage. It was traumatic. But then I got pregnant again 2 weeks later, because I had no idea that that can be a thing. You can you start ovulating again, like your body's kind of like, hey, we're ready to get back on the pregnancy train. You can get pregnant again right away. And this was the really horrific experience, and probably still the hardest thing I've ever been through in my life. We found out right around 12 weeks that we had a chromosomal abnormality. For those of you who have not had non-invasive prenatal testing, this is a blood test that they do around, you know, 10 to 12 weeks in lieu of an amnio or CVS test, which is kind of what was done before. They do it, you know, de rigueur in everyone who is over 35 now, but basically it tells you whether or not you have, you know, a high risk of a baby with certain chromosomal conditions. And it tests for four, mostly. It tests for some other stuff too now, but I tested for a fatal abnormality, and we knew from the ultrasound that it was not going to develop further. It had already stopped. And it was just a matter of, you know, weeks or maybe a month. And I had the appointment, and they said, well, you know, you're going to have to terminate. And it still kind of blows my mind to even contemplate what that meant. Like terminating a wanted pregnancy, my head exploded. And, you know, and I went through with the termination. I had an abortion. Like, I had an abortion. I had to go through, you know,
it wasn't called an abortion in that sense, right?
It's technically an abortion. I mean, when I went in and did all of the, you know, they asked me all the questions. They said, is someone forcing you to do this?
Yeah,
they,
I remember, you know, that.
Would you, I mean, and would you like to have tiny footprints and the whole thing? And I'm like, of course I don't want to do this, but I have to do this. It's healthcare. You know, and that's really become something that's quite important to me. I shared my story with Fortune recently, you know, because I think a lot of the time, although abortion should definitely be a woman's choice, I firmly believe that, oftentimes it's not.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a choice for me. Right. I had to do it. It was medical care. So, you know, but then thankfully my rather large son came along a few months later, and 41 and a half weeks, I had a pretty emergent C-section, you know, but in the course of that pregnancy, I really like that experience having this abortion when I was like, but this is not what I'm after right now. I want a baby. It really kind of made me think. And I had lunch with a friend and was just kind of kvetching to her about how I thought all the literature was pretty old-fashioned. It was really focused on, you know, a lot of things that working women just frankly can't ever live up to, like exclusively breastfeeding for 2 years and all of this stuff. I mean, it's just crazy. And I felt very disconnected from that, both as, you know, an ambitious, you know, woman who was also like, you know, on the older end, according to these books. And I said, you know, I just don't feel like anything's really written with both a practical, empathetic viewpoint that tells people both, you know, here's what we know. Here's actually what we don't know. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you what to do in these situations. You have to make that decision. And here are some frameworks to help. And so, you know, I had never written anything long, like long form, before I wrote that book. And I wrote it in 7 months. It just kind of poured out. I wrote the last little postpartum section while I was postpartum with my son. The book was due like 4 or 6 weeks, I think, after he was born. So I was like writing when he was asleep, which was thankfully a lot. And I had great help. And, you know, that made things a little bit easier. But I was still recovering from surgery. And I think,
in a very traumatic couple of years.
Yeah. Yes.
So you weren't just recovering from 9 full months of pregnancy. You were recovering from, you know, a whole lot of trauma.
Yeah.
And, you know, the good part of that story is that your first book, Bumpin', went on to be a bestseller and has helped many, many women, not only around the country, but around the world, who haven't thought about modern day pregnancy and, you know, the options and the risks and the myths and the, you know, debunking mm-hmm. some of those assumptions. And, you know, that was super helpful. But my understanding, and this is where I need you to fill me in, is that your quest didn't really stop there. And I think you realized some things along the way about the whole process of, you know, getting pregnant and carrying a baby and all of that, that were big ahas for you. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it was what led you to write your second book and to deepen your focus in this whole area. So fill us in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have gotten so many friends of mine pregnant, not like that, but, you know, like giving them guidance about
the magic.
I mean,
I love that.
I mean, listen, I am like everybody's first phone call when they're even thinking about having a child now. And a conversation that I have, I would say at least once a week, is explaining how ovulation works, because most people don't know. You know, they're like, oh, okay, so basically I have sex like the minute I ovulate, and then that's it, right? And I'm like, not unless you don't want to get pregnant, because that's probably not going to work out for you. Like,
so explain it to us. Break it down.
Yes. Sperm can live in the reproductive organs for up to 5 days. Like, they're hardy little creatures. And that is how you get pregnant. You have sex in the days before. It's best, you know, every other day, really. So, like, starting 5 days out, 5, 3, 1, and then you can do it again on ovulation day for good luck. But eggs only live in the fallopian tubes for 12 to 24 hours. So if you're just like waiting for the magical moment when it drops, you're probably going to end up missing it. The other thing that occurred to me, and this was, you know, something that I noticed both in my own relationship as well as many others, is that men are very excluded from pregnancy and fertility conversations. And you know, I'm the mom of 2 young boys, so I care about this deeply for them. But I also really care about this for women, because I think the consequences of their exclusion are quite serious. They affect women and future kids, women who, you know, who go into pregnancy with an older partner even, are more at risk for preterm birth, other conditions. Babies are born with, you know, more developmental issues when sperm is unhealthy. And then, you know, there's some other stuff I think we can go into later, just around, like, you know, the mental health of men and how that really affects, you know, affects families as well. And so I really wrote both books. I mean, this one's pretty, Fertility Rules is pretty overt about it. I'm like, I'm not trying to like Trojan horse my way in on this one. It's like male and female fertility.
Yes.
But with Bumpin', I have sections for partners to include them in the process. And my thesis is that with Fertility Rules, which is really a prequel to Bumpin', to answer all of the questions that I get all the time from friends and readers, is that if men would take a more active role in conception, prepare their bodies, and, you know, do the same things that women are kind of told to do, that they'd then be more involved during pregnancy and probably even in, you know, early parenthood, because like it's so theoretical for them.
Totally. So let's, we have male listeners. Let's talk to men and talk to the women who love them about yes. what men should do in preparation, during the process, yeah. in, you know, physical health, mental health. Let's give a little tutorial.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not super complicated, and I am not an adherent to you must be perfect. I think it's really ridiculous, the standards we impose on everyone. It's like should be 80-20, right? Like 80% of the time be good, 20% of the time, like give yourself some space to be, you know, eat some foods you enjoy. But it really comes down to lifestyle, especially for men. Sperm parameters can be really fixed in about 3 months. They can be improved a lot, many of them, not all the time.
How do you do that?
Do they have prenatals for men? Like, should they be taking some vitamins or something?
Yes. Well, so women should start taking prenatals 3 months before pregnancy, before you even start trying. But men should also be doing that. Also, cycling. Like, if you're married to a Peloton enthusiast or like a long distance biker, turns out cycling really... Yeah, get off that bike
Watch
for a while.
Balls.
Stay out of
or ride standing up. Yeah, ride standing
up. Out of the saddle.
Or they have noseless noseless seats. But I know. Isn't that interesting? It's for this use case.
That's crazy.
There's CoQ10. There's, you know, there are men's prenatals, but really it comes down mostly to lifestyle. Like move your body a little bit. You don't have to do anything intense. You know, whether we like it or not, being overweight or underweight is a major factor mm-hmm. for both sexes. You know, men who are super overweight have a hard time because, you know, body fat is an endocrine organ. So it's that is why it's difficult. Mm. It is actually regulating your hormones. It is making your body, you know, respond inappropriately. And it's the same if you're underweight. You know, if you don't have enough body fat, your hormones also can't function. So it's really, like I said, I think it's about finding a moderate place. Mm-hmm. Like I like to say be reasonable, right? You know, if you really like, you know, fast food, just like limit it. Ultimately, cutting out trans fats and you know, overly processed food is a good thing for your health no matter what. But like if you're really into McDonald's French fries, just like kind of keep it to a minimum.
Yeah. What about sleep?
But be kind to yourself. Sleep. Well, sleep's a big one too. Yeah. You should be getting 7 to 8 hours of nice uninterrupted sleep. Your bedroom is for reading and sleeping. It's not for
Having children, clearly.
And making babies.
5 days, 3 days, and 1 day before. I mean,
every other day.
That's I know. You know what's interesting, actually? There's this new movement from couples that are having trouble conceiving where let's be honest, like we've all, well, maybe not all on this podcast, Ariel, not quite yet, but like timed sex, oh my God, what a drag. Like it is not that fun after a while, especially
what
when
is
you've
that?
Had.
Like when you have a set time, like every Thursday at
hurry up.
Well, no, like when you're trying to conceive, and you're like tick-tock, like we got to do it this morning. This is the only, especially when you have kids, like trying to work it in. It's like, well, he's napping, so maybe we should go do it right now. And it's like, well, what if
that's not very sexy?
Oh my God. Yeah, that is not in my
life. People are using the turkey baster method now.
What?
Even for timed sex. It's fascinating. Yeah.
What does that mean?
So intravaginal insemination, it is quite frankly the turkey baster method where like
at home,
you know, guy goes and yeah.
Wait.
Yeah.
He puts his stuff in something else and then puts it in her?
Yeah. Correct. There are FDA cleared devices for this now. So like maybe don't use the things that you use to cook for Thanksgiving when you're doing
that
this,
could be salmonella filled.
Yeah.
Yeah. That could like, and don't shoot anything up there like ever.
Wow.
Don't,
this is fascinating. Why would that be better than it coming from the biological method?
Well, I mean, okay, so like perfect example. Here's me. Like I had five total pregnancies. Mm-hmm. How much sex do you think I had to get, like have to make that happen? Well, you
a
know,
lot.
Like A lot. It was a lot. And like after a while, sex becomes a job. And it's not sexy. It's like, okay, we should do it now. And you kind of like do it, you know, and it's fun for a while. But for most people, if they're really honest about it, you know, it's not that fun after a while because you're like, okay, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? It's stressful.
Spontaneity especially those, is gone. You know,
And if you've had a miscarriage.
That makes sense. Okay.
I want to keep talking about men because this is one of those rare topics that the woman has carried the not only the baby but the burden of all of the things of, you know, historically a woman can't get pregnant and it's her fault even though, you know, it might be that her guy doesn't produce viable sperm or whatever, but you know, historically it's always the woman who has failed to deliver the baby, the son, the whatever. So you've talked about how the partners can get as healthy as possible beforehand as the women are too. But what are the other places where men could be more sort of involved, engaged, helpful, take responsibility in this whole process?
Well, there are some sad realities that most people just don't know. One of them is, you know, issues in men's bodies are responsible for about half of infertility. The way that it breaks down is about a third is, you know, women for a variety of reasons. You know, it could be PCOS, it could be blocked fallopian tubes, could be lots of things. Gynecological conditions are very commonly at play there. The other is that, you know, it's totally unexplained. That's about a third of the time. And they think about half the time it's, you know, women and half it's men or it's a combination. But that other third of the time, it is exclusively men. And what happens today in today's fertility industry is that men in 25% of cases are never even examined. So if you're a couple going to get IVF or if you have, you know, if you've hit that 6 month mark, if you're 35 or
what's
if you've
the six
you know,
month
hit
mark?
A year.
You've been trying for six months and you're not pregnant.
Yeah. So if you're trying to conceive and you're 35 or older, the time to seek care is around 6 months.
Oh.
And then if you are under 35 and it's been a year, that is the time to start looking into it. But right now we live in a kind of strange world where there's no middle ground. There's, you know, you try and you try and you try and nothing happens. And that's tough, but then maybe there's nowhere to go because you live in a rural area. Mm-hmm. You can't afford fertility treatments because they're very expensive. They're not covered by insurance. It's out of pocket. It's a very dysfunctional thing. You know, or you do pursue them, but you can only pay for one round. And right now, the average for, you know, to end up with a live birth is three cycles of IVF. Oof.
Wow, which is how much money?
Yeah, how much is that? Yeah.
I mean, that's like 100K at the end of the day.
Wow.
Out of pocket?
Yeah, it's a lot.
And that doesn't include college, ladies and gentlemen.
Holy.
Does not.
That's just to bring the baby into the world. Yep.
Yeah.
Wait, I have a question about the one third of exclusively male like having an issue. Is the reason it 25% of the time it goes unchecked is a sort of system thing, like the doctors and healthcare, like they don't bring it up? Or is it sort of being declined, like, no, like, I'm the man, it's not? Like, what do you think that is?
It is a mixture of, it is a toxic, potent mixture of all of that. So there is a lot of resistance for some men because they just don't want to be checked because they're scared of the result. Fear really drives that because we still have this like weird relationship with sperm as, you know,
manhood.
A yardstick for a man's virility. Yeah, and it's ridiculous. I mean, I can't believe we still live in a world where this is the case, but it is. And you talk to most men and I've talked to a lot.
And embarrassing.
But it's
also not their fault.
No. Yeah, it's culture. Also, they're taught from a young age, like seeking healthcare is weak.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of interesting polls. There actually was just a piece in the Times about this, that, you know, men are not good utilizers of healthcare even when they're not infertile.
Right.
And then I think the other thing is, like, let's just be honest, private equity, you know, runs about a third of all IVF cycles now. They own clinics. And it's much more financially advantageous for them to pursue treating women. it's much more money for them.
Yeah.
They make way more money because, like, all men, you know, you do a semen analysis and a physical exam, that's not really that much money. You start doing these procedures and testing on women. The other issue is that for men, and this is something I really need to sit down and write about, is that a procedure called ICSI, which stands for intracytoplasmic sperm injection, say that three times fast, which is, you know, you have the egg and you have sperm, you get a sperm sample, you put it under a microscope, and then an embryologist or an andrologist chooses just one, and they shoot that sucker right into the egg, and then that's it. So, like, what does the fertility industry care as long as there is sperm? Like, as long as there's one, you're fine. You don't care. So that's the other thing. Like, this is, I mean, it's such a complicated.
Do they test for the quality of that sperm in the same way that they test for the quality of an egg? You know, when you harvest eggs to do IVF or whatever, they sort of say how many of them are, you know, A plus quality or whatever their ranking is. Do they do that with the sperm too?
Well, so here's a fun fact. You can't test the quality of a single egg or a single sperm because it would destroy it. It is a single cell. That's it. But so embryos you can test. So you don't really, like, you know, from, so like with sperm, right? You look at it under the microscope, you can see its morphology, its shape. You can see how it's swimming. You can see how quickly it's swimming. You can see these very basic things. They grade the sperm on like a set of five different parameters. With eggs, you kind of like, they have like educated guesses, but you have no idea. This is one reason that egg freezing is so controversial, especially to me. I think we're not really focusing enough on it, that it's not a guarantee because you have no idea what you have.
Right.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is such a good point. I had never thought about the fact that you can't test it because then you've ruined it.
Yeah, you've ruined it. Single cell. That's it.
So for women who do harvest their eggs and they're told, you know, we got 30, but only 10 or 5 are good. What does that mean?
Well, so for women, I'm going to back up and talk about egg freezing just from a macro level quickly. So it's an incredible advance for women, especially women who are going through cancer treatments, women who medically need it, or who know at a younger age that they eventually want to have children, but perhaps do not do not feel ready to do that in this moment. But the best time to harvest and retrieve eggs is in a woman's 20s. Mm. That is the time to do it. Once you've hit 35, your odds of having a chromosomally abnormal egg go up. And every year you wait past 35, it goes up. So the best time to do it is when no one can afford it. The other thing is, you really don't know what you have. One of the reasons that people like to freeze embryos, even if they're, you know, with donor sperm, is because you do know. You know that, like, okay, it's viable, assuming it survives the unfreezing process. But it's not a guarantee. In fact, women who go on to try to use frozen eggs later, it only works 39% of the time. Huh. That's the latest.
Oh, my goodness. This is
so you have to think of it like a sales funnel, right? Like, you dump a bunch in the top, and then at every step you lose eggs. And I want to say one other thing about eggs, that this was, in writing this new book, this was the hardest chapter for me to write. It made me confront some very personal things. It made me kind of, because like, we don't know why we had 3 miscarriages. I had a miscarriage between my 2 kids too. A missed miscarriage this time where, you know, the fetus dies and like your body still thinks it's pregnant. So it's all very, very strange and
painful
and fascinating. But, but you know, all anyone would ever tell me is, well, it's just bad luck. Like, it's just bad luck that you had a miscarriage. And I kept thinking to myself, there's no way that it's bad luck. Like, I can take it. What's the issue here? I wrote I submitted my manuscript to my, I had 2 editors this time, actually. I had one who was, who's fabulous. She's like 25 and one, you know, who's like closer to my age. And both of them were like, well, Leslie, like, egg chapter, pretty short. And I said, yeah, I mean, I feel like it's been covered. Like, there are all these books just about eggs. Like, this is not maybe the most, because you can't do anything about it. And they were like, okay, well, maybe think about that a little bit, but you know, you do you. And I one night just said, oh my gosh, this is all about, like, this is, I have to just tell the truth. I have to tell people that it's not bad luck. So most miscarriages happen because of chromosomal abnormalities in eggs. That's it. Like, it's chromosomally abnormal embryos. The problems occur because of eggs. And it's because your body just sucks more at cell division as you age. So when you crest 35, 37, your body just can't perform meiosis as well. And that's it.
Yeah.
Like, it's that simple. I think there's so much self-blame for people.
Is that why skin ages and all these other signs that we see is because everything has slowed down and is not, not dividing?
Yeah, your body's just not as accurate anymore. Mitosis, like that's, and then there are, it's your body. You can't Benjamin Button that stuff with a pill. It's just not yet anyway.
I love that you mentioned this, Leslie, because it takes me back to when you were doing your first book tour for Bumpin'. I went to a few of your talks, which were so great. And one of the themes that we saw, or I saw it with every audience, was this shame around miscarriage and a total lack of understanding of the statistics and the reasons behind. So it's just the sort of unresolved, this happened, it's my fault, I'm not good enough, I'm not doing my job. Age didn't even matter. It was 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, whatever. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, you were so great about addressing that, both from a medical, like sort of, you know, why this is not like something to have shame around, but also culturally, especially in the US, how the way we look at pregnancy from the pee stick moment can affect the way we feel and the way we kind of treat ourselves about what might happen in those early days.
Well, I mean, this ultimately comes back to this whole, you know, women-centric view of the world we have when it comes to pregnancy and fertility. And it does seem like it's a lot more obvious. It seems like it's a lot more, it has to be all on the women because the women are the incubators, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's how we're treated a lot of the time. It's like, well, you're carrying a baby around. Like, isn't that special? So
let me touch you.
I think, let me touch you. Let me call you for good luck. Who's good luck? it's bizarre.
It's weird.
It's a bizarre. I had that happen to me one time, and I was like mystified. It's like I know you mean well, but would you touch
me
if I wasn't
pregnant? Get your hand off my
belly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't come rub my stomach if I wasn't pregnant. It's very tempting, I know, but yeah. Listen, like, we still have a very female centric view of all of this, and this is another reason I think it's so important to bring in men. Like, yes, meiotic errors are the main reason that miscarriages happen. Mm-hmm. Chromosomally abnormal embryos, which, you know, it can happen during my mitosis later too. But just really taking you guys back to high school biology right now. I don't even remember what I got in biology. It's very rarely your fault. And like, we should just pause on that for a second, because people think they have miscarriages because they fell down, because they exercised too hard, because they ate, you know, something weird, they got food poisoning, they got sick. It's very rarely for that reason. And there are studies that show that recurrent miscarriage is tied to DNA fragmentation in sperm. So it's another thing we just don't know. We don't know that much about sperm, which seems kind of strange since it's like half the basis for human life.
But, a little bit weird, you know, there.
That's your third book. Don't know much about sperm, Jack.
You know, it's not a bad third book. I'd love to write a men's health book.
Yeah. Well, and I just feel like other cultures don't do this as much. Like, I see, like, I go on TikTok right now, and I'm 29, so constantly all I see are like pregnancy reveals and, oh, I'm announcing my pregnancy and this and that. And it's the pee stick thing. It's like pee stick, pee stick, pee stick. But my understanding is that's not like you're in the clear right when you pee on a stick, like 10 minutes after, you know, you got pregnant or whatever, because so many women experience miscarriages that they don't even know about, right? Like, this is what I've read before, and you've mentioned it. So I wonder why. I don't know. I guess I just, like, I have an Australian friend who told me, oh, yeah, this is crazy in the U.S. that you guys post and do all this pee stick thing. Like, in Australia, we don't even consider ourselves fully, like, good to go until we have whatever doctor's appointment, like, however many weeks later.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish we would do that
here. I think that's a shift in your generation, though, Ariel, because it used to be you didn't even tell maybe even family until you were 3 months, you know, until you were past the first trimester.
Really?
Yeah, because so many things go wrong in that first period. So I just think
maybe
it's now living
instant,
our lives so exposed on social.
And instant gratification and like that need to have everything now, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it makes sense.
I mean, I think there's also like a spirit of transparency. Like, this is a journey that I'm on. I want to, you know, talk about every single thing that's happening on that journey. And, you know, what I tell people, because that's a question I'm asked a lot, is like, when do I tell people at work? When do I tell family? When right. do I tell friends that I am pregnant? How do I think about that? Especially like, I'm a professional woman. Like, you know, when do I tell my boss? And what I always say is, you know, you can tell people whenever it's comfortable for you, as long as you're happy to share the bad news along with the good. And, you know, as I know well, and anyone who's encountered infertility knows, like, you really do need support. You need, you know, I got therapy after my second miscarriage. I think it's such an underutilized tool in those situations. I went to grief therapy to process what had happened because I couldn't relax. Like, I was so stressed out and so upset and waiting for things to go wrong. But, you know, like, I think it is just it's a generational thing. I think there's more talk of it now. You have more, you know, Chrissy Teigen came out and talked about, you know, the pregnancy, like those pictures were just, I mean, I cried. I cried when I saw those pictures. It just brought it back for me. And then Jennifer Aniston talking about how she went through fertility treatments and it didn't work. And I think like those kinds of stories are so important because on the other hand, you also have, you know, other celebrities who say like, well, I have miracle twins at 47. Okay, well,
that's not setting a great expectation.
It's probably an egg donor, and it is a miracle for you, and I'm thrilled for you. But you have to set context for people that, you know, it's really no one's business. But if you're going to talk about it, I think it's important to be forthright. And that is, we still have a ways to go with that.
Leslie, are there examples of men talking about whether it's fertility challenges or male perspective? Do we have enough role models of men?
No. I mean, I think Jimmy Fallon talks about it. He talked about their IVF journey. But I think because we still equate male fertility with virility, it's very difficult to get guys to talk on the record about it. And I think that that's one reason there aren't, you know, also, I mean, there are an enormous number of men's health companies starting now, because I think people have appropriately noticed that it takes two people to get pregnant, and men need care too, for all kinds of reasons. You know, I mean, another reason we should all care about men's health. What do you think the number one cause of maternal mortality is?
Murder.
Wow.
Is that
right?
The
first person I've asked. Yeah.
I am deeply steeped in the women's number one death source is murder in every situation, pretty much. Pregnant.
Why, Ariel, why are you deeply steeped in that?
Because I love true crime. So I know many, 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 many. I love it in a, not in a, wow, sensational, crazy. It's like, how is this still? It's getting worse, actually. It's not getting better. Not to be a downer, but it just blows my mind.
But we hear about so many women who get inadequate care and die because of complications in childbirth or things like that. I mean, that was, if you hadn't come up with murder, which I never would have come up with, I would have said something like that. I would have said a complication.
Like hemorrhage, postpartum hemorrhage.
Yeah.
That's what most people guess. It's a mix of, you know, access to guns, and then it's also mental illness, because men are even more unlikely to seek mental health treatment than women.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I think you're seeing a through line in my work that, like, yes, I care about men because I'm married to one and I like him, and I also have two of my own. But also, men's health has an outsized impact on women, and men who are unhealthy can't show up as good partners. They can't show up as supportive parents. And ultimately, it shifts the burden right back onto us. Also, women are undergoing fertility treatments when there is no reason to. I think we'll look back on this time and we'll see that, like, maybe the three cycles of IVF that it takes a lot of people for it to stick, it should have been two, or it should have been one, just because we're not testing men and we're not treating men enough.
I've seen this, and I don't know if you feel this too, in our, and I would say the last year and a half or 2 years of our conversations with all amazing women, I have seen this lean that is sort of in the frame of men's liberation is our liberation from so many of these issues that we're trying to fight and we're trying to fix. We have to do it together. We have to help, you know, we have to, men need to be better 100%, but they need help. So
100%.
I think it's so interesting.
Another way to think about it too is, you know, you both have spent some time in startup land. What happens today when a female founder pitches a health company that focuses on women? And I saw this with Maven. I was involved with Maven very early on. It's the first billion-dollar company in women's health. You know, she would have meetings with male investors who would say, well, you know, I guess like I can go home and ask my wife about this. But
yeah, or have the female partner talk to you. Yeah.
Yeah, or I'll have the female partner talk to you. I think until men start taking care of their own bodies and understanding that fertility is real and it's important, mm-hmm. we're also not going to see the kind of investment that we need in women's health because they just don't understand the problem because they don't experience it because they don't know.
Yeah.
So I also see like, you know, it's kind of a back end way to increase, you know, the attention we give to women's health.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So true.
All right. Let me ask you one last question before we go into the new speed round that's going to close this all out. You know, you're sort of not even maybe midway through your career, through your life. You've already experienced so much and you're raising two children and you're becoming a role model for all sorts of people who can have healthier relationships with, you know, each other, with their bodies, with the process of, you know, not only having children, but parenting. So can you look at yourself in the future and say, I would like my legacy to have been blank? Like, what would you, when we talk about Leslie Schrock at the end of days, what did you do that makes you feel like you lived a good life?
Wow. I mean, I certainly want my boys to look at me and both not be horribly embarrassed that their mom talks about sperm all the time and think that that's okay. You know, and feel really proud. But I think if my boys can look at the work that I've done and they feel like I've made a difference in their health and the health of their peers and the next generation, that's pretty meaningful. And then I think that another thing that's been pretty consistent about my career, you know, even back at Rock Health, like, am I a doctor? No. But is anyone else willing to step up and having like, have this conversation, write this book, like do the work? No. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe that's on my tombstone. Like Leslie Schrock did the work, said stuff loudly, enthusiastically even. I mean, if that's my legacy, like I look at myself as kind of a journalist educator now. And, you know, and I'm very proud of that. I also still invest and I still do many other things, but saying the hard thing out loud. My uterus is everybody's business. It's fine. I'm good.
Perfect. I love that.
Boom.
So much.
Mic drop.
And it's so you and it's so true.
It is.
So,
it is.
Incred. Okay. Welcome, my friend, to the rapid fire round where I'm going to throw some questions at you. And you're going to answer it as quick as you can and keep it as short as possible. Sound good?
Great.
Okay. Number one, introvert or extrovert?
Introverted extrovert. I need my private time.
Okay. Heard that.
I'm a big reader.
That makes sense. Okay. What do you wish people knew about you?
I have a really weird sense of humor, but I think most people know that if they follow me on Instagram.
You do post the best NYT cartoons.
Yeah.
I am a good cook too.
Yeah. Ooh, okay. Noted. Next, what's the hardest lesson the world keeps putting in front of you?
Not seeing what's obvious. Ignoring it because it's hard.
Yes, that's fair. Okay. Do you prefer a night in or a night out?
I like my one night a week out, and most of the time I'm too tired and sick from kid illness to have too many nights out, but I love them when I have them.
Okay.
I had one last night. It was great.
Wait, is kid illness this thing where kids are always sick because they're always like at school and touching things and then the parents get sick?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because they're Petri dishes. Yes. I live with two Petri dishes and I've been sick for over a month.
My little Petri dish.
So no, there have not been a lot of nights out for me because I've been too sick.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Just clarifying for us childless people. Okay, what's your favorite room in your house?
I mean, I really love actually where I am right now. It's where I get to think and be and, you know, but I also love like we have a little playroom in our house and I love like sitting in there with the kids and like watching them throw themselves at walls and stuff.
And the room you're in now
the padded
is what?
Walls in that
your
room?
Office?
Yes, this is The Office.
The Office. Okay, amazing. Okay, what's a movie everyone should watch?
Amelie.
Oh,
wow.
Sex Woman. I remember being little and my mom watching that and me being like, oh my God. When she's like, how many people are having sex right now? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Fantastic music. It with is great. A great soundtrack.
It's a banging soundtrack. Okay. What's the perfect snack, Miss Foodie?
Oh, man. That all depends. There's a really good croissant shop down the street, and I find myself wandering down there to take
a
break.
Snack croissant for sure,
or a Queen Amon. That's actually my favorite snack right now.
I love those too. Okay, two more. How do you celebrate at the end of a great day?
I mean, at the end of a great day, I'm spending time with my kids, and we have dance parties in the kitchen.
Hell yeah!
Frequently.
Love
my
that.
Older son loves David Bowie.
Oh my gosh, old soul. Okay.
So, and we don't play like kid music really. I play
except for
like
Baby
Ella
Shark,
Fitzgerald.
I've heard
and
around
Armstrong.
Your house a little bit.
Well, yes.
Oh God.
Yeah, baby. Well, it's the bane of my existence. That and like the Bear Hunt. Bear Hunt, The Floor is Lava, and Baby Shark do make some appearances.
Is this all Cocoa Melon?
It's not.
Oh,
We have a little Tony's box. That's our, we don't do a lot of screen time.
Okay. Fair. Okay, who would play you and your best friend in a movie?
Oh, somebody thought I was
Ashley
Tisdale
in a movie.
Once.
Who would play you?
Or you.
Yeah. Somebody, like, there was a guy at the San Francisco airport one time that was absolutely convinced that I was Ashley Tisdale to the point where he thought I was lying about my name. He thought I had a fake ID. He's like,
oh,
your secret's
God.
Safe with me, Miss Tisdale.
I had the same thinking I was Ellen DeGeneres. So there you go.
What?
I was with the kids at a shoe store, and this person would not accept that I wasn't Ellen DeGeneres and did the same winky winky, your secret is safe.
That's
with
insane.
Me. And I happen to love Ellen, but yeah, I don't totally
I see
it.
Princess Diana for
I
you.
Totally.
And I don't really see Ashley Tisdale. I see like why someone might think that just because like blonde and like cute. I don't know.
Pretty.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Pretty. Yeah.
Mira Sorvino is the other one, or Holly Hunter. Those are the three that I always get. But it was like uncanny.
Aniston.
Yeah. Jen Aniston.
I mean, I'll take that any day.
I have heard now from three separate people in my life, because I'm getting married and everyone's talking about babies to me, of course, that when that time comes, there are ways to have the type of like to basically there are ways to get pregnant with like a boy or a girl. So there are ways to have sex that you'll either get a boy or a girl if you want, or it like increases the odds. And I have to ask you, there's no way that's real, right? That's my question.
Correct. It's 50-50 odds.
Exactly.
There are boy sperm and girl sperm. So, okay, there's one theory that is fun, but it is a theory. And let me reiterate, it is a theory. There is no proof that this is true. But there's a theory that because male sperm are a little smaller and faster than female sperm, that having sex as close to ovulation as possible means that you will have a boy. Whereas if they're like hanging out in there, the female sperm are a little hardier.
Right.
So
that's what I've heard.
If it's one of them, then and they find the egg, you know, because the egg actually pulls the sperm in. It's not this like, you know, thing. They emit this kind of scent that the sperm are attracted to.
The
and then
egg
they,
seduces
yeah, the egg is
the
cool.
Sperm?
The egg totally
that's
seduces the sperm.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's really cool.
The knowledge of our body is just the coolest thing ever. Okay. Confirmed. It might be true. That's what I'm taking from this. No, I'm just kidding.
It's true. It's as true. It's as true as you want it to be, but it's still 50-50 odds, my friend.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
Egg seduces the sperm. I love that. Like, this should be animated.
Best,
we should have t-shirts that say that. I mean, yes.
Right? We should start a show, like a mini series animated that's like the sassy
egg.
Betty Boop, Jessica Rabbit.
I love
egg.
That. I love that so much. And it feels.
I do too. And classic us doing all the work, even inside
the
of the fallopian tubes. So. Yeah.
Work with what you got. But, you know, Leslie brings up so many great points about the role of men in this equation. And while you and I have been involved for years in running a women's organization where women get to talk about stuff that matters to us, more and more frequently, men are reaching out to me and to us saying, hey, when are you going to do Parlay House for Men? When, you know, men don't get in our society to have these intimate conversations and to talk about vulnerabilities and to share truths like infertility or whatever it is. And it's such a good point. And while we don't have the capacity to take on, you know, doing all of this for men right now, I really hope in the future that there are men who want to step forward and start to have these conversations. So yay for men that are stepping up
100%. Yes.
Yep. And what you and I started doing this podcast because men can listen to all these conversations and be part of real people who shine and people who shine that get real. And Leslie was certainly both of those things today. So, you know, when you come back next week, whether you're coming as a woman to Parlay House events or you're coming as whatever you want to be to bring a friend, you know, we hope you'll bring someone of any gender, any identification anywhere, because we talk about things that are real and meaningful and fun, and there's always room for a friend.
Yes, we do. Let us seduce you back next week. We'd love to see you. And when you come, bring a friend. If it seems life is heavy.